Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, July 24th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. Our mini editorial today is written by Richard Sater of Sioux City, and Richard writes, "After reading Thursday's mini editorial, it reminds me of what my mother said to me 60 years ago. I should have moved to California. I'm sure glad she didn't." Again, this was written by Richard Sater of Sioux City. We'll start with a story about the RAGBRAI. The headline is, 2022 RAGBRAI Expo brings foam, salt tabs, and tens of thousands of cyclists to Sergeant Bluff. For the entirety of Saturday, Sergeant Bluff was the center of attention in Iowa. Tens of thousands of cyclists, hundreds of support team members, and dozens of vendors descended on the town of 4,901 for the 49th edition of RAGBRAI. Though the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa would not officially begin until Sunday at dawn, crowds came motoring on in their buses and vans to get set up and to scope out the day of Expo. Just in the parking lot of Sergeant Bluff Luton High School, vehicles with plates from California, Colorado, Georgia, Illinois, Minnesota, Missouri, North Carolina, Texas, and Washington could be seen. RAGBRAI is expected to draw more than 20,000 people this year and will weave through Ida Grove, Pocahontas, Emmitsburg, Mason City, Charles City, and West Union before ending in Lansing. Temperatures are expected to stay in the 80s for much of the week. By noon, campgrounds were already encircling the school. Staffers at a Stanford Letch's bike shop dutifully tended to the needs of riders. Smash food trailer and a self-proclaimed pork crew served up food and drinks as country music wafted through the air. "You're in your own little bubble here," said Shannon Tisland, a second-time rider from Edmonds, Washington, who brought along his entire family, including four kids age 11 and younger, to the week-long 462-mile ride. "I did it 5 years ago. It's a cool experience. We just love the atmosphere, and it's great family bonding." For kiddos and their parents, the park at 901 First Street in Sergeant Bluff had the splash pad running as well as a foam party with a live DJ. At any one time, a handful of children could be seen darting in and out of mist, spraying playground equipment, or dumping buckets of water on each other. A dozen more would frolic through mountains of foam unleashed by a machine called the Foam Daddy. For adults, the expo, which overtook 4th Street, offered more bicycle-minded booths than any one person could possibly patronize in one day. Included in the wares available for purchase, a device that charges a person's phone as he or she pedals, plentiful amounts of salt tabs, packets of pickle juice, helmets in all the colors of the rainbow, and something called a crud cloth, which is meant to act as a sort of shower on the go. Certain folks were selling items for local causes. Mike Beeves of Jack's Kettle Corn said, "We are raising money for the Siouxland Youth Wrestling Club today." Staffers, largely volunteers from in and around Sergeant Bluff, would circle around the expo grounds on a regular basis to make sure that. That was the end of the sentence. Al Ackerman, a Sergeant Bluff resident who pitched in to help out at the Information Center, said the past few days of prep work were among the most hectic of the six-month run-up Sergeant Bluff had to hosting his second ever RAGBRAI launch. The first was in 2006. Still, any stress Ackerman was feeling was superseded by love for Sergeant Bluff. "We just have a great town and I love helping the town," Ackerman said. Amber Bliss, a coordinator for the Information Center, said the organizers saw a steady trickle of people all day long. "We have had people asking us questions nonstop, but it hasn't been overwhelming. It's been hot. We had to help someone with heat exhaustion, but other than that, it's been good." At least one truism of RAGBRAI is that the level of experience can vary wildly, even within friends groups getting out on the trails together. Don Linton journeyed 750 miles from Rolla, Texas, an eastern suburb of Dallas, to participate in his first ever ride across Iowa, while his buddies Scott Russell and Bob Frank, both from Texas, were respectively on their 10th and 21st RAGBRAIs. "I never had a bike good enough to do this," Linton said. That changed when Russell sold him one of his own bikes and wore him down with tales of RAGBRAIs gone by. Frank, an Omaha native, said his first few years of Ragbri he would ride alone, but he never felt lonely. "I just enjoy being out with cyclists, and Ragbri is like a big party," Frank said. As he gets older, Frank said the toughest part for him really is the 100-mile day, which will be from Emmitsburg to Mason City this year. Friends Drew Engelhart, Meg Schwarzenfeier, and Amy Amin ventured out for their inaugural ride from North Carolina and Washington, D.C. Schweissenfeier and Amin are doing the biking while Engelhart provides support from a van. The two also said the 100-mile day was the thing they were dreading most, while Engelhart said he was most concerned about finding them at the end of the day. First-timers Yuji Tanaka and Ifanu, both of Santa Clara, California, worried aloud about the 100-mile day as well, but also were delighted at the chance to camp and to sample a variety of foods. Just a few of the offerings at the expo were burger, Mexican, and barbecue-related. Tom Williamson, a Rochester, Minnesota resident, did not seem scared of the 100-mile day. According to him, the most difficult aspect of Ragbri is the work beforehand. "The toughest part is to get out and do the training necessary to have fun," he said. "If you're undertrained, you'll have a miserable time." As for what he's most looking forward to, that's an easy one. "You get up in the morning and you know what you're going to do," Williamson said. And a related story has a headline of "Sioux City Experts Offer Advice to Weather Ragbri and All Those Towns." On Sunday, Sergeant Bluff will be the starting point for this year's 462-mile Ragbri. The ride across Iowa has been a staple summer event since its birth in 1973, when two Des Moines Register riders, John Karras and Don Call, made the trip. Since then, it has turned into the longest, largest, and oldest recreational bicycle touring event in the world, according to the Ragbri website. A ride this long can be daunting for new cyclists. Being prepared for the journey is key if the goal is making it from the Missouri River to the Mississippi River. Two Albrecht Cycle Shop employees, Corey Smith and Steele Welcher, offered advice to those who are making their first attempt at completing Ragbri. Smith has completed two Ragbris and has helped others complete many more, and Welcher has 10 Ragbris under his belt. "Being smart about what a rider carries during Ragbri is an important part of having a smooth and enjoyable experience. A packing list will depend on whether the rider is on a team or going solo. In his two Ragbri rides, Smith went without a team. "I've typically packed my stuff, so I try and go on the lighter side of things," he said. "I just pack two jerseys and two pairs of shorts for riding." The jerseys and shorts Smith is referring to are made specifically for cycling. They are quick drying, skin tight, and light. Welcher, on the other hand, rides with Siouxland cyclists, meaning that he can store extra clothes in a vehicle that meets them at overnight towns. "You could bring your own outfit, jersey and shorts for 5 to 7 days, but it's not necessary," said Welcher. Both riders suggest carrying a small bottle of multipurpose soap, such as Dr. Bronner's. "You can wash your plates with it, your jersey, yourself, whatever you need to," said Smith. Having money handy, cash in particular, is another essential, no matter if you're riding with a team or alone. "You need to bring cash, small bills," said Welcher. "Everyone is handing these vendors $20 bills, and if you had ones and fives, it would be a lot easier." Other important items include sunscreen, a spare inner tube, and basic tools for small bike fixes. One of the most valuable things a rider can have, according to Welcher, is wet wipes. Sometimes the porta potties run out of toilet paper, or you're eating food and get chain grease on your hands, said Welcher. They are very nice to have. An already taxing ride can become even more difficult if one is not properly hydrated or has had enough to eat. "Have a drink before it is too late," said Welcher. "Make sure you are drinking water every 15 to 30 minutes or so." Smith says that while sports drinks may be helpful in some cases, having one when you are dehydrated may not help as much as plain water. "They'll kind of do the job, but if you're really dehydrated, all those extra sugars tend to not agree with you," said Smith. "An electrolyte supplement will work better, and you can get them almost everywhere. Some dissolvable electrolyte tablets have caffeine and give you a boost, as well as a little bit of flavor," said Welcher. "There's probably a little bit of flavor, too, which will help you drink more water." One of the most popular drinks to have during Ragbri is beer. While everyone handles the beverage differently, Welcher usually saves his drinking until the evening when the riding for the day is done. Everyone is different, said Welcher, but the carbonation on a hot day, expanding my stomach while I'm hunched over riding my bike, it can be problematic. So sometimes I save that for the evening. Welcher has similar thoughts about eating. His preference is to graze throughout the day so as to not to overeat and become lethargic. It is important to indulge in homemade foods, though, he says. Definitely be on the lookout for any type of local food, anything that is unique, he said. Homemade pie, ice cream, corn on the cob. You've got to stop for anything that's that kind of specific to this region. This year's Ragbri is expected to be hot and humid, making proper rest and pacing a must. I've talked to people from Arizona who came to ride, said Welcher. They are surprised that there are hills in Iowa and by the humidity. They are used to 100-degree days, but not with the moisture. According to the Albrecht employees, there would be no shortage of places to stop and rest. Pass-through towns are on the route, spaced out roughly 10 to 15 miles apart. You have all day to complete the ride, and you're starting at 7 or 8 in the morning, said Welcher. You usually have to stop and walk through the towns, and you're probably stopping to have a snack or watch the entertainment. That is one of the unique things about Iowa. We have little towns everywhere. Ragbri will go through 5 towns in just the first day of riding. After starting in Sergeant Bluff, it goes through Bronson, Anthon, and Battle Creek before finally stopping in Ida Grove. A rider's mental approach to the ride can be do or die for some. My personal model is, I don't have a ride, I have to get to the end, said Smith. That's the destination, I have no other way of getting there. Smith also encourages riders to look around at others while cycling. I think that enables a lot of people. They're seeing everyone else doing it and thinking, oh yeah, I can do that. Finding a ride buddy is another option. You can get a ride buddy, said Welcher. It doesn't have to be somebody from your team or club. You meet somebody on the road who's going the same pace as you. A lot of people strike up conversations, and that helps you get to the next town, through long segments or the whole day. Ragbri riders will gather at Sergeant Bluff on Saturday before departing Sunday morning. We'll now move into a different type of story with the headline of With Strong Polling, Money Advantages, Reynolds Focuses Criticism on Biden, National Democrats. A little more than 3 months out from Election Day, the early measurables suggest Kim Reynolds, Iowa's Republican governor, is a heavy favorite to earn another 4-year term as the state's chief executive. Reynolds has dominated the campaign's fundraising efforts, and early polling suggests she is overwhelmingly the choice of Iowa voters. 4 top national election forecasters all rate Iowa's gubernatorial race in their strongest category for Reynolds' win. Deidre DeGeer, the Des Moines businesswoman and the Democratic challenger, has lagged far behind Reynolds in fundraising and polling. DeGeer has been attempting to make up that difference on the ground by hosting public campaign events across the state. With holding a comfortable lead in the polls while running for a re-election in a state that has a low opinion of the Democratic President Joe Biden's job performance, Reynolds appears satisfied, at least early in the campaign, to focus her criticism on Biden and congressional Democrats rather than on her opponent, DeGeer. Reynolds frequently blasts Biden and Democrats in Congress in her media appearances. She rarely mentions DeGeer. With Governor Reynolds having that lead, she doesn't necessarily have to talk about issues. The challenge for DeGeer will be to bring the issues to the governor, said Donna Hoffman, a political science professor at the University of Northern Iowa. Certainly, Governor Reynolds can try to nationalize this election because it's in her best interest to do that. Run against Joe Biden, run against Joe Biden's policy, tie Deidre DeGeer to Joe Biden. Reynolds was chosen by national Republicans to deliver the party's response to Biden's State of the Union address in January. The Bureau reached out to the Reynolds campaign on Thursday and will update this story if the campaign responds. At a campaign event this past week in Cedar Rapids, DeGeer said she is focused on reaching out to Iowans. I don't necessarily need the governor to engage me. We all know that I am the governor's opponent, not President Joe Biden, DeGeer said. And it's clear to me more now than anything, especially as consistently that she has mentioned his name, that her perspective or focus is not on Iowa. Her focus is on something else, and we need leadership in the state to focus on us. Who needs my attention? Iowans. Iowans need my attention. Iowans need the attention of their governor. So if she says my name or not, it's not the end of the world. What's more important is that we connect with the voter. That's who I am focused on. Desjure said she plans to travel to all 99 Iowa counties, a practice made famous by a longtime Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, to reach voters in all corners of the state and to continue to raise money for the campaign. Ann Desjure said the early poll results do not concern her. Over the past week, the Des Moines Register MediaCom poll, considered by many to be the gold standard in Iowa politics, showed Reynolds with a 17-point lead, and a poll commissioned by Iowans for Tax Relief Foundation showed Reynolds with a 15-point lead. Rick Stewart, the Libertarian candidate for governor, was at 5% in the Iowa poll. "We knew that this was going to be a hard race," Desjure said. "But where we are right now, it is really about digging deep and working our plants, and we'll see the fruits of our labor." Tim Hagel, a University of Iowa political science professor, said there is still time for Desjure to chip away at Reynolds' lead because many voters are not yet tuned in to the 2022 election campaigns, and because many voters have not yet become familiar enough with Desjure to form an opinion about her. "Having said all that, yeah, a 17-point lead is pretty big," Hagel said. Hagel and UNI's Hoffman said Reynolds came into the campaign with at least two key foundational advantages. Iowans historically like to vote for their incumbents, regardless of political party, and Biden's low job approval numbers nationally and in Iowa make it hard for Democratic candidates to win here, especially statewide. Most national polling aggregators show Biden's average approval rating in the 30s and disapproval ratings in the upper 50s. Even though technically he's not on the ballot, everybody knows that, effectively, a midterm election is a report card on how the president's doing in the first 2 years of the administration, Hagel said. And for the Biden administration, it is not looking too good. And so that's what allows Republicans to focus their attention perhaps on him and what's going on there, rather than necessarily your opponent. The general election will be November 8th. In Iowa, early voting will start on October 19th. Our next headline is Cedar Falls Boy Survives State Park Attack. A 9-year-old boy survived the attack that killed three members of his family Friday at Marquetta Cave State Park. Tyler and Sarah Schmidt, both 42, were found dead, along with 6-year-old Lula Schmidt. They were from Cedar Falls. Cedar Falls Mayor Rob Green issued a statement late Friday on Facebook saying the family was camping at the state park. The Schmidt's 9-year-old son, Arlo, was also there. He survived the attack and is safe, Green wrote. Authorities said the suspected gunman, 23-year-old Anthony Sherwood, was found dead in a wooded area of the park with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Mitch Morvet, assistant director of the Department of Public Safety's Division of Criminal Investigation, told the Associated Press on Saturday that the motive for the attack was still unknown. "We don't know what led up to this, what precipitated it," he said, adding that so far, the investigation has not revealed any early interaction between the Schmidt family and him. Green said the family was his neighbors and that Sarah Schmidt was a Cedar Falls Public Library employee. "Like many of you, just hearing the news, I'm devastated," he wrote in the Facebook post. "I knew Sarah well, and she and her family were regular walkers here in the Saratori Park Ave neighborhood. He had spent some time working with her during the past week on a presentation." Cedar Falls, which borders Waterloo and Blackhawk County, is just over 2 hours northwest of the Quad Cities. Home to the University of Northern Iowa, the city has a population just over 40,000. "Details will be forthcoming about services and other memorials, and I will ensure the community knows about this," Green wrote. "Please offer some extra grace to the Schmidt's many friends, neighbors, and co-workers as we try to process this horrible tragedy." The Cedar Falls Library was closed Saturday for the sake of the staff who loved and worked with Sarah, he added. A GoFundMe account has been set up for Arlo and has raised about $58,000 by mid-afternoon Saturday. The Des Moines Register reported that Sherwin came from La Vista, Nebraska, a suburb of Omaha. La Vista Police Chief Bob Lostern told the newspaper that Sherwin had lived in an apartment complex with his parents and that he had no history of criminal conduct. Autopsies on Sherwin and the victims were scheduled to be performed over the weekend, Mortvet said, and more information would likely be released based on those findings. East High School graduate named 2023 Rivercade Queen. Natalie Cloud was named the 2023 Queen of the River during the Rivercade Royalty announcement at the Marriott Terrace Ballroom on Saturday. Cloud graduated from Sioux City East High School in 2021 and is currently majoring in elementary education at Morningside University. She also plays on the Morningside women's soccer team and is a part of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Cloud has volunteered at Greek Fest, Nativity Confirmation, and the South Sioux City Diablo Soccer Tournament. As part of the Rivercade Royalty, Cloud plans to have fun with other young adults, gain confidence and network towards the benefit of her future career, according to her bio. "I was not expecting this," said Cloud after the announcement that she had been selected as queen. "I am really excited for this opportunity to represent Siouxland. I'd like to thank Jennifer Swanson, my parents Kelly and Andy Cloud, and everyone that is a part of Rivercade." Another East High School graduate, Sydney Helt, was named one of the princesses. Helt graduated from high school in 2022 and will attend Iowa State University in the fall, planning to major in biochemistry, hoping to graduate from the University of Iowa Medical School and become an emergency medicine physician. Carly Phillips, a junior at the University of South Dakota, was also named a princess. She is majoring in media and journalism with minors in Spanish and business. Phillips is part of the USD women's cross-country and track and field team, writes for USD's newspaper, and is a new anchor for the Coyote News Daily Update. We'll now move to the opinion page, and the first thing is a Sioux City Journal editorial, which is headlined, "Citizens Need to Hear What the January 6th Committee Uncovered." Thursday night's primetime hearing was more riveting than anything on a $6 a month streaming service. For nearly 3 hours, viewers heard testimony before the House Select Committee investigating January 6th from a variety of sources close to the Trump White House. They saw Missouri Senator Josh Hawley raising his fist in solidarity with the mob outside, then racing down the halls of the Capitol after the mob entered the building. They heard how Vice President Mike Pence's security detail called family members to say goodbye, and they got outtakes from a message President Trump taped that showed he argued with advisors, including daughter Ivanka, regarding what he would say. The broadcast also included profanity, the kind network television does not air, and a sense that the committee had more than proven little was done to prevent the insurrection. The witnesses weren't disgruntled Democrats looking to score political points, but Trump insiders who tried to get him to call off the masses, but he would not. Some resigned. Others pointed out how incomplete the president's response was. Tim Murtaugh, Trump's director of communication, wrote a text that said it was wrong not to have acknowledged the death of Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick. Matthew Wolking, another official, said the lack of response was enraging. Everything he said about supporting law enforcement was a lie. Clearly, the evidence is there to prove Trump did not preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, as it says in the oath of office. But where do we, as a country, go now? Should the former president be charged with something? Should he be prevented from holding office again? Should we file this in the back of our minds and move on? Or should Congress figure out how it can prevent an insurrection from happening again? Clearly, the broadcast brought much to light. Those of us who can believe in our country can't brush it off and expect life to be the same. As teachers might say, this was a learning situation, and we, the citizens who don't always want to get involved, need to pay attention. Again, this was a Sioux City editorial. And then we have some letters to the editor, and our first one is written by John Newman of Denison, Iowa. And John writes, "A woman should and does have the right of choice. She has the right to choose to get pregnant or not. Rape is the exception. She should not have the right to cut out an unborn child, to steal the life of a baby, of a fellow human being. People often say, we have to protect the children, or we are doing this for the good of the children, in regard to climate change, school shootings, child abuse, playground safety, vaccinations, car seats, etc. How about the future children? When do we start protecting babies on the way? Women or girls have an unwanted pregnancy because of irresponsibility, laziness, lack of good judgment, or plain stupidity. She has control of her body before she becomes pregnant. These unwanted pregnancies can be prevented. Methods of birth control, contraceptives, even the day after pill are readily available. After she becomes pregnant, her choices are to deliver the baby, to love it forever, have it cared for by another, or give the baby up for adoption. Ending a baby's life in the name of reproductive health care is not a choice. This unborn boy or girl is not a tumor. It's a growing life. How is an abortion not seen as killing another human being? It's really immoral. Why is the baby's right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness never thought of or considered? It is very fortunate that all the women protesting for their right of choice were not aborted. Regrettably and sadly, their babies were not as lucky or blessed. Again, this was a letter written by John Newman of Denison, Iowa. Our next letter is written by Victoria Knudsen of Sioux City, and Victoria writes, "It was a shame to read such a misleading letter in the Sunday Journal regarding the name of the Democratic Party. A quick search online leads to a Wikipedia article stating that the term Democrat Party is not only grammatically incorrect, but also an epithet started in the 1940s as a slur against Democrats. The real name is indeed the Democratic Party. The article was very informative as to the history of this wrong name and how it is used today. It is Fox News and their ilk that have the name wrong. The shame goes to them." Again, this letter was written by Victoria Knudsen of Sioux City. Our next letter is written by John Thomas from Vermilion, South Dakota. John writes, "Although the original intent of specific sections of the Constitution are often debated, the general intent of the Founding Fathers is clearly expressed in the Constitution's preamble. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Sending abortion rules back to the states arguably violates most of the Founding Fathers' intentions, as expressed in the preamble. Instead of a more perfect union and domestic tranquility, we will have a hodgepodge of conflicting laws among the various states. Under current law in Texas, private citizens, bounty hunters, can sue anyone who aids or abets an abortion and receive a $10,000 reward if the suit is successful. General welfare? Doctors must decide how close to death a woman must be before they intervene so as to avoid lawsuits. Since 10 to 20% of all pregnancies terminate in spontaneous miscarriages, many frivolous lawsuits may result. Blessings of liberty? Women are less free to make their own choices. In restrictive states, the status of pregnant women will be essentially reduced to fetal incubators under penalty of law, with no consideration given to family situations or best medical practices." Again, this letter was written by John Thomas of Vermilion, South Dakota. Our next article on the opinion page is written by Jim Wexner. A Sioux City resident, Jim Wexner is the retired executive director of the Siouxland Mental Health Center. He is the current board chairman of the Winnebago Comprehensive Healthcare System and is a former member of the Sioux City Council. He and his wife Bernadette are the parents of 3 adult sons and the grandparents of 9. And he writes, "Given the state of political divisions in our country growing ever wider on a daily basis, I have been prompted to reflect on a comparison with China. Xi Jinping, the party boss and president of China, is fond of saying that China is one country with 2 systems. That references to the nature of the relationship between mainland China and Hong Kong and Macau. The express fiction is that somehow the mainland and those 2 entities can coexist with a certain level of autonomy and freedom. Of course, that is not true anymore than China's supposed liberation of Tibet and the uplifting of the Uyghur people by forced re-education in Western China. In our land, we are rapidly moving toward 2 countries under 1 system. Unfortunately, that is not a fiction. We remain united as a country, but nearly half of the states are moving in 2 very different directions. Our institutions remain in place, and at least we have a somewhat cohesive foreign policy. However, on the domestic level, our differences are beginning to rival the bitter times prior to the outbreak of our Civil War. This has been most obviously manifested in the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. But the divisions are widening on countless issues. From voting rights restrictions to the gerrymandering of congressional districts, state legislatures have poisoned the electoral process. The vastly different views and laws related to gun control are another example. Rights that were once accepted as just and constitutional are now considered fair game to modify and revise. We are divided on the approaches to the climate crisis that may destroy the planet. It is not only the people who represent us. We, as a people, can no longer find common ground around the basic values that we need to unite as a nation. Issues of racism and childhood poverty plague our society. I fear the direction that we are headed, and I pray that we come together to respect one another and solve the grave problems we face. I intend to keep harboring that hope and commit myself to fostering that effort wherever and whenever I can. Let us work for having one country with one system for all. Let's all keep hope alive. In that spirit, I wish to conclude this column with two very positive developments worth mentioning. First, the implementation of a national suicide hotline number that will be life-saving for so many people. That number is 988, and it is the mental health hotline to call when one is in crisis and considering self-harm. The call will be answered by trained counselors familiar with local resources. The pandemic has enhanced isolation and heightened anxiety, depression, and other mental illnesses for hundreds of thousands of individuals. So, access to this number and the people responding is a remarkable achievement. This may be one of the most positive developments associated with the pandemic. I encourage everyone to spread the word about this number and encourage people to call when necessary. The other positive development is the recent merger of the State of Iowa's Department of Public Health with the Department of Human Services. This has been years in the making, and it will make a big difference to the people of our state. This merger was effective July 1st, and now all the details are being worked out. The most significant part to the merger is that it allows the medical expertise of the State Health Department to be directly involved in the delivery of care to the mentally ill and developmentally disabled Iowans. Further, it overcomes the obstacles to the delivery care to those individuals who unfortunately suffer from both mental illness and substance abuse. The majority of states already have combined these services, and this is a huge step forward for Iowa. As Director Kelly Garcia states, "This is a major milestone in a monumental effort to really think holistically about how to serve Iowans. I am glad to conclude this column on such positive happenings, and I sincerely hope and pray that there are more to come in the future. Keep the faith and never lose hope." And this was an article written by Jim Rexner. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, July 24th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to today's obituary. We'll begin with Jacqueline Micheline Jackie Hartnett, 89, of Hubbard, Nebraska, passed away peacefully at home on Tuesday, July 19th, surrounded by family. Public visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. with a vigil service at 7 p.m. on Wednesday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Funeral Mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Hubbard, followed by burial at St. Mary's Cemetery in Hubbard. Online condolences may be directed to meyerbroschapels.com. Jackie was born on October 6, 1932, in Sioux City to John Francis and Cecilia Sullivan Cahill of South Sioux City. She attended elementary school in South Sioux City and later enrolled at Bishop Heelan Catholic High School, where, in 1950, she was a member of the school's first graduating class. Jackie married the love of her life, Jim Hartnett, on February 5, 1951, and together they lived in Hubbard for over 70 years. While raising a family of nine children, they partnered to build a successful farming operation. Jackie was head of logistics for J. Hartnett Farms, a Herculean daily undertaking that she did with aplomb. Jackie was awake before everyone, cooking suppers and dinners for armies of family members and hired men. running down parts to keep equipment humming, keeping the books, moving implements, her own sons and men across miles of fields for their next task, preparing and transporting meals across the farm, from the swamp to the flat to the horseshoe, and to the great frustration of both, sometimes helping Jim sort cattle or hogs. Jackie's work continued late into the evening, cooking, washing, chopping, mending clothes, acting as a medic for her kids' bruises and cuts, and, sometimes in vain, getting everyone to bed at a decent hour. In her 40s, Jackie accomplished her long-term goal of becoming a licensed nurse. In addition, Jackie was a dedicated and resolute public servant for over 30 years. She was elected to 5 successive terms as a Dakota County Commissioner. She also served for 6 years on the board of NACO, a statewide association representing all county-level officials. Jackie proudly served as president of the association in 1997. Jackie spent her final years in health care as a frequent volunteer in Mercy One's intensive care unit. Jackie was a lifelong proud Catholic. Her deep and abiding faith drove her to shower others with love, care, service, and counsel. She spent every morning on her knees in prayer. Her favorite curse, Jesus Mercy, was also a profound and brief prayer in moments of exasperation. Jackie was a decades-long member of St. Mary's Catholic Church in Hubbard. She and Jim donated the funds for the construction of the parish center that has been the site of countless church, community, and family events. Jackie supported St. Mary's as an EMHC lecturer and a member of the Altar Society. She was active in Catholic Daughters of America and the Northeast Nebraska Catholic Deanery. Jim and Jackie's generous contributions to Bishop Heelan Catholic Schools are commemorated with a plaque designating the English department in their names. Jackie loved good books, classic movies, and Broadway show tunes. She was a wicked bridge player and dominated all types of board games. Jackie was an excellent writer. Her handwritten cards and letters are cherished by their recipients. Her innate style was warm, elegant, and admired. Jackie's personality and intellect were enormous. She was effortlessly charming and so accessible. Once you met Jackie, you were her friend for life. Jackie's wit and grace were renowned. She instantly connected with anyone, hired men, patients, bridge groups, church members, and her Hubbard neighbors. She had the rare gift of making you feel like you were the only person in a room full of people. Jackie was singular. For her loved ones, there will never be another like her. Most importantly, Jackie's love for her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren was boundless. She treasured each of them. She was a wise and comforting matriarch to 3 generations of Hartnetts and their loved ones. Jackie relished spending time with her large and raucous family. At holidays and family gatherings, Jackie was always surrounded by a cadre of her adult children, grandchildren, and usually 1 or 2 great-grandbabies on her lap. No family event was complete until Jackie led everyone in grace before a meal. She ended the prayer by saying, "Thank you, Lord, for letting us all be together." Russell Rusty Gill, 70, passed away peacefully on Tuesday, July 19th, due to a long battle with multiple illnesses. Per Rusty's request, there will be no services, and he asked that everyone celebrate his life through your love for all music. Arrangements are under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Rusty was born January 29, 1952, in Sioux City, the son of Tom and Marilyn Gill. He attended Central High School, graduating in 1969. He went on to playing guitar and dreaming of becoming a star. He wrote 100% original songs, to include a 45 record titled "It's Only When I'm Lonely" when he was 16. He played in several bands, to include The Last Chapter, Freight, and too many more to mention. You could often find him sitting in with bands, playing guitar with anyone who would take him. He also played solo gigs at The Patio, The First Edition, The Paddock, Joe Mars Bar, and so many more. In 2005, his band, The Last Chapter, was inducted into the Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, performing in Okoboji. The band included original members Dave Schultz, Jim Wentworth, Dave Wenberg, and Rusty on lead guitar and vocals. Rusty married Gail Pilgrim in 1968, and they had a daughter, Kimberly. They later divorced. He then married Patty Gill in 1984, and they had a daughter, Kelsey. Both his daughters brought purpose and meaning to his life. Rusty was a one-of-a-kind guitar player and singer-songwriter. There wasn't a song he couldn't play, especially by the Beatles. Listen to his music at soundclick.com. May that sun shine on you forever, Rusty. Mary Joanne Kleinberg, 87, of South Sioux City, passed away Friday, July 22nd. Services will be at 10 a.m. on Wednesday at First Lutheran Church in South Sioux City. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 on Tuesday at Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Mary was born the daughter of Carl and Ollie Stewart on June 15, 1935, in South Sioux City. She graduated from South Sioux City High School in 1953. She married her high school sweetheart, Terrence Kleinberg, on September 3, 1954. They made their home in South Sioux City. Joanne worked for the phone company as an operator and for a time in sales until her retirement. She was an active member of First Lutheran Church for 73 years. She enjoyed teaching Sunday school and Bible school for many years. Susan Sue Johnson, 70, of Kingsland, Texas, formerly of Sioux City, of South Sioux City, passed away on Tuesday, March 8th, quietly with her husband by her side. Celebration of life will be held from 1 to 4 p.m. on Sunday, July 31st, at Covington Links Golf Course in South Sioux City. Susan was born November 3rd, 1951, in Sioux City, the daughter of Jerry Abel and Bertha Abel. She married Ronald Johnson Sr. on October 23, 1970, in Elk Point, South Dakota. She worked for Zenith, Opportunities Unlimited, and Bickford Cottage, all of Sioux City. Susan loved to crochet, play the slot machines, and was also a huge Big Red fan. She enjoyed time with her dog, Teddy, but most of all, she loved people and being of service to them. Dolores Louise DeHardy, 93, of North Sioux City, passed away Thursday, July 14th, surrounded by her family. Celebration of life will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Burial will be at the Memorial Park Cemetery. Dolores was born on March 28, 1929, in Chicago, Illinois, to John and Ella Goss. She was united in marriage to Cecil DeHardy on June 26, 1985. Followed by a lasting relationship with Norb Kemp. She worked as a key punch operator for IPS for over 30 years before retiring. Dolores was a huge baseball fan and loved watching the Cubs and the Cardinals. She enjoyed shuffleboard, bowling, playing cards, puzzles, and dancing. Most of all, she loved her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. The family would like to thank Hope and John at St. Croix Hospice for the care they gave to Dolores. Coach Raymond Ray Casey, 85, of Sioux City, passed away on Monday, July 18th, in Columbus, Nebraska, while surrounded by his family. Service will be held at 4 p.m. on Saturday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Visitation will be 2 hours prior to the service. Ray was born on May 29, 1937, at St. Joseph's Hospital in Sioux City. He attended Sacred Heart Elementary School in Sioux City and graduated from Heland High School in 1955. He went on to the University of South Dakota, where he completed a bachelor's degree in 1960 and a master's degree in 1965. He was an avid lover of sports. In high school, he participated in football, basketball, hockey, baseball, track, and boxing. He played college baseball at USD and later played for many years with the Homer Hawks. Many remember him as an umpire, a football referee, and a hockey official. He loved the Notre Dame Fighting Irish and the New York Yankees. Ray married Sandra Everingham on October 1, 1960, in Sioux City. He was a dedicated lifelong teacher and coach. He began his teaching and coaching career at Sacred Heart High School in early Iowa, and later moved to South Sioux City, where he taught and coached at South Sioux City High School. He accepted a new opportunity at West Junior in Sioux City and then transferred to East High School, where he retired in 2003. He also taught several classes at Western Iowa Tech. We would be remiss if we did not mention and acknowledge the numerous friends who had the opportunity to share a drink, a laugh, or a story with Ray or Coach. It warms our hearts to know that so many were able to do so. Herman Jody Cresswell, Sioux City, 73, died Tuesday, July 19th, Services will be July 29th at 6 p.m. at Waterbury Funeral Services of Sioux City at 4125 Orleans Avenue with military honors. Emma Christine Kerr, Sioux City 19, died Tuesday, July 19th. Services will be July 26th at 10:30 a.m. at the Beyer Brothers Colonial Chapel at 3220 Stone Park Boulevard, Sioux City. Karen K. Rood, Sioux City, 78, died Wednesday, July 20th. No services are planned. Arrangements with the Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Robert J.W. Bob Vint of Punta Gorda, Florida, formerly of Sioux City, passed away Sunday, May 1st. Celebration of life will be held at 2 p.m. Sunday, July 31st at the Stone Lodge at Stone State Park. Bob was born in Hartley, Iowa, and grew up in Sioux City, where he graduated from Helan High School. Bob was the son of Marianne Hubert Vint, a teacher who encouraged her children to become avid readers, and Thomas Francis Vint, a businessman and entrepreneur who urged his children to pursue their dreams. Bob's early career was as a therapist and advocate for individuals who experienced addiction and for victims of abuse. He had a rather nomadic lifestyle for many years, eventually ending up in Virginia, where in 1988 he met the love of his life, Loretta Reeves, on a blind date. They were married almost 34 years. Bob and Loretta eventually settled in Punta Gorda, where he joined her professionally in commercial development. They also worked together on a joint passion, caring for English Springer Spaniels in need of rescuing, saving a stunning 87 dogs. Bob's humor and grace, and no doubt his legendary stubbornness, helped him overcome real adversity in his own life and to become the advocate for so many people and dogs loved and leaned on over the years. He truly believed in the goodness of people, valued meaningful conversations, and was a lifelong learner. He loved sharing time with his children, Angela and Bart, and grandchildren, Sean, Niobe, and Riley. Many grand adventures were spent together as a family and with his sister Donna and nieces Miranda and Kara. Trips together were full of giggles, new experiences, and occasionally full contact spoons. Marvin L. Simons, Marcus, Iowa, 87, died Thursday, July 21st. Services will be July 26th at 10:30 a.m. at the Grace United Methodist Church in Marcus. Burial will be following services at Marcus Amherst Cemetery. Visitation will be July 25th from 4 to 7 at the church. Arrangements with Ernest Johnson Funeral Home in Marcus. Joseph Jerome Snyder, Sr., Luton, Iowa, 65, died Sunday, July 17th. Services will be July 28th at 1:30 p.m. at the Bacon Creek Park, Sioux City, with military honors. Arrangements with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Dorothy A. Henshaw Johnson, Ottawa, Iowa, 89, died Thursday, July 21st. Private family service and celebration of life will be held at a later date. Arrangements with Gosler Funeral Home and Monuments, Ottawa. Merle Britton, Sioux City, formerly of Lamar's, 65, died Tuesday, July 19th. Celebration of life will be from 4 to 7 Saturday, August 13th, at the Willow Creek Shelter House at 813 Park Lane Northeast in Lamar's. Arrangements with Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamar's. Ellen Louise Honey Griffin, 85, of Sioux City, passed away on Wednesday, April 6th, at a local hospital following a short illness. Graveside services will be held at 9 a.m. on Saturday at Calvary Cemetery. Celebration of life will follow at the Sioux City Country Club from 10:30 a.m. until noon. Father David Heeman will officiate. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel assisted the family with initial arrangements. Ellen was born on August 28, 1936, in Keokuk, Iowa, to Raymond and Hazel Cooper. She graduated from Keokuk High School and attended the University of Iowa. On October 19, 1956, she married Michael R. Griffin in Keokuk. Michael passed away on January 28, 1994. Ellen remained in Keokuk until 1967, then spent years living in both Iowa City and Portland, Indiana, before settling in Sioux City in 1976. She worked in the floral industry and held positions at many floral shops, including ownership of Elmwood Flower Shop and Honey's Hobby. She ended her career at the Carousel of Flowers in South Sioux City. She was a longtime Girl Scout leader and a master bridge player, but her passion was in florals and anything flower-related, especially weddings. Memorial donations in Ellen's name may be directed to the charity of your choice. We'll now move to the sports section with the Zach James column with the headline, Despite No Titles, Remsen St. Mary's Boys Athletics Accomplishes Hard Feat. The faces on the players of the Remsen St. Mary's High School baseball team were hard to look at. There were tears streaming down their faces, and the hurt coming from each Hawks player was a sight all too familiar this school year. The Hawks could not complete their perfect season on Friday in the Class 1A baseball championship against New London, but there is one feat that those kids from Remsen should be proud of. The Hawks were perfect in all regular season games during football, boys basketball, and baseball. They won all 8 regular season football games, all 20 boys basketball, and all 28 baseball this summer. I know, and these were regular season games. Now, I know some people will say that it's the end result that will matter at the end of the day. That's true to some extent. The Hawks just didn't have the right bounces to clinch state titles in those 3 sports. But if I'm one of those kids at a future class reunion, that's definitely a stat I would bring up. And baseball coach Dean Harpino agreed, even after the 8-7 loss to the Tigers. That's crazy, and you don't see that every day, Harpino said. If you look at it, we lost half our football team, and we had no linemen left, and we still battled. Key guy injured, and in basketball, this was kind of a new group and lost it to North Lynn. They still put themselves in situations, and they're still successful. Some of these guys have been to 12, 13 state tournaments. They did win a football state title in 2020. Obviously, we wanted to win a title today, but it didn't happen. Harpino thought one big key for the Hawks was how together the community was. Granted, a lot of coaches say that, but the Remsen St. Mary's community has to. There is just 47 kids in the Catholic school in Remsen. So in order to have that success to visit state tournaments every sports season, everyone needs to get along. And it seems like they do. Junior Jackson Bunkers was crying after he realized he wasn't going to play with the seniors again. They work out the little things, Harpino said. They trust each other. Plus, they have to bring in some freshmen and sophomores, and sometimes that can be a conflict. Sometimes they can put their arms around them and make it a family. That's what this group does. That's the key. That family aspect will be just as important going into next year, which starts sooner than you think. The first day of football practice is August 8th, with their first game coming August 26th at Harris Lake Park. The Hawks won't just be happy with going 8-0. They want to win it again, just like RSM did in 2020. It's not just the boys' side who has found success. The Hawks softball team made it to state last week, too. While they weren't as fortunate to win the Class 1A title as Twin Cedars of Bussey did late Friday night, the Hawks are bound for more success down the road. They return a lot of main and role players from this school year, and just like the boys, the Hawks may make a state tournament or two in the 2022-23 school year. We'll now do a letter from Dear Abby. Dear Abby, my wife and I have been married 47 years. Since she retired from her job, she has become addicted to her DVR. She records everything she can think of to watch later. She has shows she recorded from last year but hasn't watched, and they take up 90% of the DVR disc. She uses only about 10% for new shows that she watches to make room for other programs. So every night, we have to watch what she has recorded that day to make room for the next day's recordings. If I say anything about it, she gets very upset and it causes tension. I don't mind some of the shows, but there aren't that many I will spend time watching. I wish there was a support group for husbands of wives who are addicted to their DVRs so we could understand what's going on in their heads. How should I deal with the problem? Signed, Save for Later in Texas. And Abby responds, If there is a support group for husbands of compulsive wives, I am not aware of it. The solution may be to inform your wife that she can now stream many of the shows she's been saving on the DVR. A compromise might be viewing one of the archive programs a night in addition to the new ones, if possible. However, if she's not agreeable, consider buying yourself your own television set. That way, you are not obligated to watch anything that you don't wish to. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, July 24th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.